Nice to see what are now familiar faces, so I thank you for coming in many cases a second time. What do they say? Doesn't Oscar Wilde say something about to lose one parent might be an inadvertence or something, but to lose two is downright carelessness? Maybe to make the same mistake a second time, something similar. I was reminded coming back this evening of an Irish or English, he was both really, Dominican called Herbert McCabe, famous man who died recently. But during the course of his career as a theologian, he was invited by the ecclesiastical authorities to keep quiet for a while, you know, to be silent. And then after some years, the silence was lifted, and he merely walked to the microphone and said, "As I was saying." Well, as I was saying yesterday, the distance isn't quite so enormous. God is active. It can look otherwise, but really the Judeo-Christian story is a story of God active in history, and the history reaches its pinnacle in what God does in Jesus and is doing still. And this Jesus, what he does, we see, is climaxed in Holy Week, where he shows both his solidarity and love with all victims, innocent victims too, and also his saving of us because of the mistakes and wrongdoing that have been part of our lives. And the picture at the end of Holy Week, you have seen pictures here already, will be of a Jesus with his arms spread out, blood and water flowing, indicating that God in his Son has given everything for us. This death on the cross is something that we're familiar with as Christians, and yet we don't really understand it all. Sometimes when I'm in public places like supermarkets or shops or whatever, and I see young people with crosses, two things happen to me. One is that I'm drawn to them slightly more because the symbol is something that I'm familiar with and it evokes a warmth. But on the other hand, I feel that what it means is so beyond our power to grasp that no matter how much we think about it, there is a kind of scandalous character to a Savior who hangs on a cross and to a Messiah who ends up in such a powerless state. So I'm proposing this evening, in a sense, two difficult themes, but I think with glimmers of hope, approaching Easter in troubled times, to look a little bit at sacrifice and suffering, because the cross is the supreme sacrifice of Jesus, and also the suffering that he undergoes is evident, and we know of suffering in our own lives too, so there's a deep connection. Sometimes, because the cross is so difficult to fathom, we have learned to understand it maybe in ways that are not so helpful and may not actually be found in Scripture. For example, somehow we have picked up the message at times that the suffering of Jesus is something willed by God, and that Jesus himself mysteriously but somehow wishes to be a victim. If you think of God as willing the suffering of his Son, and Jesus as embracing victimhood in a way that is difficult to explain, you end up with a fairly sinister image of the Father, don't you? What father would wish that of his or his son, or what mother? And similarly, you end up wondering about Jesus. Is he glorifying suffering? Is it all about suffering? Why is suffering so central? Most scholars of the New Testament would now agree that there is no need to understand the death of Jesus either as something that the Father vengefully wills, or victimhood as something that the Son actively glorifies. Instead, they would stress, first and foremost, that God is love, and that Jesus came among us as God's love enfleshed, and that when he died and why he died was because his faithful love was simply too much for a world that was tilted in the other direction. That Jesus' love held a mirror up to the situation in which he lived, and his death wasn't that his Father wanted vengeance or atonement even, or that Jesus was glorifying victimhood in some way, but rather that what he stood for, his Neil tradition of including everyone, his coming as servant rather than Lord and Master, his striking, as I mentioned yesterday, at the hypocritical basis of the Jewish cult and his action in the temple that angered the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees, these were the things, fidelity to which, led Jesus to get into the kind of trouble that led to the authorities thinking, he'll have to be eliminated. You remember the words of the high priest when people weren't calmed down? He said, it's better that one man die for the people. This actually happened, but his death meant something quite different to what the high priest had in mind, isn't that right? The high priest was willing to sacrifice him, that order would be restored, and that they would have their control. So Jesus died really because he refused to compromise his message about the kingdom of God, even though it was not popular. This is important because we see then, if we read our New Testament carefully, that because of how he lived, and because of fidelity to that, because really of love, he had the courage not to compromise the truth that was his message about the kingdom. And because he lived like that, he died like that. But what his Father willed was that the Son would love. And the Father knew that that love would be costly. But it wasn't the desire of the Father that the Son would suffer. But in a world tilted against love, sometimes people who do love radically are the object of reproach. We spoke yesterday of things like the gesture of the foot washing. From John's Gospel, you know, instead of the Last Supper account typical of the Synoptic Gospels, you have this prophetic gesture. But really what it does is it sums up Jesus' entire life. The meals he's been having, the inclusive invitation to all and sundry, the giving of his whole life is now summed up in this gesture. And it also is a gesture saying what the meaning of his death will be. Before we finished yesterday, I suggested to you that if you had time on the bus, in the kitchen, in the shower, getting up, walking here, that you could reflect on ways in which we participate in the salvation that Jesus is bringing. Salvation means wholeness. Jesus is, to be sure, mending us again, Humpty Dumpty put back together. But he's doing much more than that, because he's exercising this solidarity with us in love that is affirming who we are and standing with us in all our troubles. So when I suggested that you might reflect on whenever you have received an increment of salvation, I could have called it a snippet. In other words, a moment of forgiveness, understanding, through the smile of a human face, just at that time when you thought, I'll stumble, I can't go on. And somebody or something makes a difference. Can that not be a snippet of salvation, an increment, a touch of what God is offering us and offering us this week so fully in what he does for us in his Son? And I also asked you to maybe reflect on how you could have been an occasion of an increment of salvation to other people. Perhaps in your lives you have heard yourself say occasionally, oh, thank you, you really saved me there. We use the word a lot more than we realize. Now there's no comparison between the salvation that Jesus brings, which takes care of us so completely, and the snippets of salvation that we both receive in everyday life and are a foretaste of the salvation to come, and also the increments of salvation that we share in giving to others, it's clear that God is the backdrop for it all, and anything we do that is salvific is a participation in his life. But at the same time, if the Christian message is true, the kingdom is already present among us. He is already saving now. And the things I speak of are a participation in the life-giving that comes out
of the way he lived his life,
and particularly of what he did this week, the last of his life. What I have in mind here is that Christians serve the world by being detectives of salvation, detectives of grace. Grace really means the presence of God in the world in tandem with human things. Grace always turns up escorted. It never comes like a bolt from the blue. If I said to you, sorry, I was late this evening, I met Jesus just on the way into the university and we got talking. Well, you'd say, that's nice. He's lovely, isn't he? He's quite a pious Irish man. But if I said it again tomorrow, you'd say, what's this meeting Jesus outside the university? You'd say that's too naive. And normally we don't have experiences like that, that are bolts from the blue, that knock us down from our pedestals or whatever. But we do have enfleshed encounters with a saving Christ through our relationships with one another. And you know what I mean. And I think a great service that Christians can provide for others is that we say like John, oh, there goes the Lamb of God. Oh, look at his footprint here. Often in a hindsight, like Jacob, truly God was in this place and I never knew it. But if what is real in what Jesus is doing, if it's real, then somehow we who are its recipients are also bearers of salvation in at least an incipient way to others. I didn't speak yesterday much of sacrifice. I don't think I used much traditional language, in fact, about the cross and the passion and all that. Not because I don't think it's important, but I'll explain in a minute. I was lucky this year because John's Gospel is at the forefront. And the Gospel for today and yesterday are scenes from John. And John gives us the foot washing. And we have that unique account in which that prophetic gesture of Jesus impacts us so much. And you can clearly see from John, right up to the moment when the body of Jesus is presented on the cross and blood and water are flowing, when his side is pierced, you can see that love is the motivating factor of everything that Jesus does. This love at the center. I think you have to speak of that first if we want to understand sacrifice rightly. Because the reality is that we don't live in a society or a culture in which sacrifice, including religious sacrifice, is commonplace. It's not like that we have, like the early Christians, the background of Old Testament sacrifice. So if I were to use the language of sacrifice a lot, without placing it in its deeper, if you like, matrix of nourishment, which is love, then we could have a distorted understanding of what Jesus is doing on the cross. But today, I will try to make some sense of that term, sacrifice. You are accustomed, and not wrongly, to thinking of the death on the cross as a sacrifice, and to thinking of the Last Supper in terms of the institution of the Eucharist, and Jesus giving his body and blood, the bread and wine, his body and blood, as a sacrifice for sins. You have been taught that, right? And it is true. This sacrifice is represented here every day. It's the same sacrifice, the one sacrifice of Christ, which once and for all achieves our salvation, but it's represented here every day, and we participate in it when we partake of the body and blood. From the very earliest time, Christian tradition has tried to understand what Jesus is doing using the category of sacrifice. And so, I want to look at it today. In the early Christian tradition, against the background of the Old Testament, they understood ritual sacrifice more easily than we do. Today, we're in danger, perhaps even of thinking of sacrifice wrongly, unless we, as the Americans say, back up the truck a bit and ask ourselves what it is we're saying when we're using a word so ancient, so anthropologically strange, so culturally different, and so we look at it today. First of all, the sacrifice of the cross. Think of the poem of Herbert. You know the poem of George Herbert, Love. Love bade me welcome, but my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. And then love cajoles, and the person enters in, and so on. What's clear in that poem is that God takes the initiative, and the person, you and me, are involved, invited. And into this invitation is both God who fixes our wrongdoings and God who is in solidarity with us in love. It's very interesting, but often overlooked. And so I know I stressed it yesterday also in that overall perspective that I gave, that many people are writing these days about how God is present with us in the things that befall us innocently, and not merely in those things for which we ourselves bear responsibility. I don't think anybody will disagree with me that the most difficult question for Christian faith, and the greatest trial for us as believers, the greatest challenge to faith, is the question of why innocent suffering. Again and again we see people who live good lives, and the bombshell of an illness, an accident, or some other awful circumstance hits their lives, and you say, why them, or even why me? People don't so much have theoretical difficulties with faith, but often have difficulties with the apparent random injustice of what happens to people who are good and innocent. One important perspective on this question, which you know it can't be fully answered. If I could fully answer this, I'd be a rich man and probably also a crook. But the truth is, one perspective on it is that Jesus precisely, who is himself an innocent victim, is therefore with all those particularly who suffer innocently. And I mean very concrete individuals. I mean people who suffer from violence, sexual assault, brutality, bullying, exploitation, all the things that happen to people, as well as people who are victims of capricious accidents or struck by horrible illnesses and so on. We can't always say why these things happen, especially if they are not caused by other human beings. But we can be sure that God is present in Jesus, with innocent victims, for the simple reason that he himself is an innocent victim. There was a song. People with my hair color might remember it. My mother used to sing it. It was by a fellow used to sing it called George Formby. Remember the name? Some people, perhaps nearer to my age, are laughing. The song was, and I don't mean to be flippant now, I'm leaning on the lamppost in the corner of the street in case a certain little lady goes by. Oh me, oh my, I hope that little lady goes by, etc. So the guy is there, waiting for you-know-who to pass by. Now the extraordinary thing about this song is that I hear it echoed in the background of a pastoral letter of an Irish bishop who was very holy but hadn't a romantic bone in his body. But in his Lenten letter of 1996, this bishop wrote a really beautiful passage away from the usual business of focusing on the cross in relation to sin, and actually picking up, it made me wonder, does his mother sing that song? Because subliminally it is present in the pastoral letter. You know the song I mean? Hear the letter now, and you can't imagine this man. Completely conceptual, he taught metaphysics. He never had a romantic thought in his life, but he had a deep feeling for Jesus. And he wrote this: the lover always seeks, the lover seeks always and only the presence of the one he loves, or she loves, so that they may be together. In different ways, he contrives to be where he knows the loved one will pass. We must all pass by the way of suffering, and that is why Christ is already there. To be already on the cross, because it is there that he knows he will meet us, and be able to draw us to himself. Such is the love revealed in Christ. Isn't this the understanding and love that assures our hearts that there is meaning to life? Very interesting for an unromantic man. He's depicting Christ as lover, waiting at the place where the loved one is most vulnerable and where he knows she'll pass, the place of suffering. I said yesterday that there's one thing that unites us, and it's death, the knowledge that we will die. I will say today that there's another thing that unites us, and it's suffering. Because nobody who lives, and especially nobody who loves, manages to avoid suffering. But it's interesting that Archbishop Desmond Connell is pointing to a Jesus hanging on the cross, hanging around, as it were, to run into the loved one in the place of suffering. But he does not say, first and foremost, in the place of sin. He is there because he knows we suffer. And if that's from sin, he'll be there for that too. But the perspective is the same perspective as yesterday. The desire to be close, and like any person who loves somebody, the desire to be close above all in those moments when the person you love is most on their uppers. St. Ignatius Loyola would ask you, coming before this Jesus who's waiting there for you, and it's a good exercise to engage in, what would you imagine yourself saying to him? Much more importantly, what would you imagine him saying to you? This is real prayer, talking out of the kitchens of our lives, out of the places where we're most ourselves and where the bite is strongest, out of the real tough spots. And prayer really is a dialogue of unprotected existence. He takes an unprotected position before us so that we needn't be afraid to come. Whatever we're carrying, he's already carrying the same. His arms are open, and our arms are prized open. And the journey of prayer is no more and no less than four eyes, two people, standing before each other in the vulnerability of love. Joseph Ratzinger, a name you may have heard, as a young theologian, he once said about the cross, thinking in these terms, "The cross reveals who God is, and also who we are, because it reveals God as just one ocean of self-outpouring love. And it reveals us in all our puniness and smallness. It reveals us as the objects of God's inexhaustible love. You can't get away from it," Psalm 139. There is no getting away from the fact that God wishes to drench us with divine love. It is there for the taking, open and pouring, and that's what these texts are about. This week we focus on the mystery of that love, and we call it, as you know, the Paschal mystery, basically the suffering, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus. I'll say a word about the resurrection tomorrow, and I really look forward to that. I think I'll wear a green shirt. New blades rising. But we have to face in a little bit to suffering and death in order to get to the resurrection. And it is, after all, Holy Week. They would never invite me again if I funked it on the major theme. It's much nicer to talk about resurrection, but you know yourselves that it always comes after a dying. There is something about the cross that we really don't want to look at. It's quite strange. St. Paul speaks of the folly of the cross. We make it nice in different ways, don't we? One evening at an evening mass when I was a young graduate student, I did a horrible thing to my congregation that I knew quite well. There was a cross behind the altar, and I said, "Isn't that a lovely cross?" And I kind of got them seduced into saying it was a lovely cross. And then I slammed the viewpoint. How could the cross be lovely? The cross is horrendous. The cross is a scandal. That our Messiah hangs on the cross is embarrassing. In New Testament times, a Messiah figure who didn't survive was an embarrassment to those who had followed him. So, of course, I talked to the congregation afterwards, but what I was really trying to communicate was that we can grow familiar with the symbol of the cross, and we can make it nice, and we can put garlands on it, but we forget that there's something really horrendous about it, and also something that is very hard to understand about the cross. Peter was able to say to Jesus, "You are the Messiah," but he wasn't able to take it when Jesus said about the suffering and that he was going to Jerusalem and the Son of Man would suffer. Peter missed the point completely. And you saw yesterday how he missed it again, because he refused the foot washing because he had some intuition of what it really meant, the death that it really signified. I remember an interesting event once when I lived in the States. I knew a family, and they lived in a neighborhood where people were of different religious backgrounds, very common in America. And one day we were going to Mass. I was visiting them, and we were going to a Franciscan church. And the little boy next door used to play with the little boy in the house where I was visiting. So he asked, could he go to Mass? So we did the politically correct thing, and we asked his parents. They said, fine. You know, they didn't mind where he went as long as, you know, he was safe. So we went to this Franciscan church that we were quite familiar with. But the kid spent the whole of Mass looking up at the suspended figure of a bloodied Christ on a wooden cross. You know, it was hanging from invisible suspending cords or whatever. But he kept looking. But afterwards, we had a most extraordinary conversation in a McDonald's. He asked all the right questions. Who is that guy? What is he doing? How did he end up there? Why did he do it? For us? But his questions, it really showed me that the cross is a symbol with polyvalent meaning that you can sit before and pray before and be before, and it plunges you deeper and deeper into a mystery that once discloses something to you and at the same time leaves you more floundering. It's an amazing reality. When I was a novice, struggling desperately to be pious, something I haven't managed to do yet, and that's 40 years ago, there was an old priest in the house who was extremely awkward. He used to kick all the furniture when he ran into it. He broke the toaster when he made the bed and all that. But he had a very deep faith. And he said to us one day at Easter, and we never forgot it, he says, the only way you'll understand that, pointing to the cross, is spending hours and hours and hours and hours in front of it. There is no other way. This brings us back to a point that we touched yesterday, but it's a really lovely point, and you know it well. We looked at Mary of Bethany yesterday, and we noticed that she was both extremely loving in her action to Jesus, but that also she got his message. And I suggested that because she lived inside the relationship of love with him, she lost the worldly eyes, and she acquired the eyes of Jesus. St. Paul says, in your minds you must be the same as Christ Jesus. We're meant to be like that, aren't we? But it only comes through relationship. When my father had been a while dead, and my mother one day said to me at home, "Oh no, Jim, no, we don't do that here." And I raised an eyebrow gently and I said, "We?" And she looked at me and she said, "Ah, sure, he's still everywhere." They had been we for 50 years, and they were we still. She went about the house talking to him, giving out to him as usual, all the things, but she lived in his presence. When she spoke, I remember he could finish her sentences. When she spoke, he could finish her sentences, not all the time, but they knew one another with a familiarity, and they were able to see out through each other's eyes. I once became aware of this at a dinner. They were both short-sighted and they had glasses. And he forgot his glasses and he couldn't read the menu. And he said, "Helen," to my mother, he said, "give me your glasses." And I said to my brothers and sisters, "They see with the same eyes." And you should have seen him in her horn-rimmed spectacles. She had glasses like Margaret Thatcher. And so what I'm saying here, and I'm moving, you know, hovering around the mystery of suffering too. Suffering is awful and it's inexplicable. especially when it's innocent. You can be certain that when you suffer, you don't suffer alone. One of the awful things about suffering, an illness, a bereavement, the breakup of a relationship, one of the most awful things about it is that nobody understands. In truth, they don't. Even if they've been bereaved, they have been left behind, they have been lost or broken away, it's not the same. Your experience is unique to you. So in addition to the awfulness of suffering, is the isolation you feel. And that's why the message that he hangs there, with you, gone there because he wants to be with you in that, is important. And that's why I stress the being in relationship with him, so that we begin to see with his eyes, wear his glasses. And so the folly of the cross begins to make some kind of mysterious sense. St. Augustine gives us help with this in a very nice text. Sermon 174:3. Don't all rush to the library. He's speaking about Zacchaeus. Remember the little guy? Whose life was by no means a paragon of rectitude. But he wanted to see Jesus. He was curious. So he was tilted in the right direction. And because he was a little guy, he climbed a tree. And then he was able to see Jesus and meet his desire. Now, Augustine has a remarkable sermon on Zacchaeus, and he reminds us that he was lowly and small, but that the crowd was proud. He contrasts Zacchaeus, who was willing to shoot up the tree, with the lofty, regal crowd, who had no need of doing that. Augustine says he climbed the sycamore tree, and as he climbed the sycamore tree, let you be invited, Augustine says, to climb the cross on which Jesus hung. Because if you do that, you will see him. How similar to the message of Father Murphy, isn't it? About going and being before it. The tree on which Jesus hung for you is the one that you can climb if you wish to see him. And Augustine continues. These are his own words. The crowd you see says to the lowly, to people walking the way of humility, who leave the wrongs they suffer in God's hands and don't insist on getting their own back on their enemies. The crowd jeers at them and says, you helpless, miserable clod, you can't even stick up for yourself and get your own back. The crowd gets in the way and prevents Jesus from being seen. The crowd which boasts and crows when it is able to get its own back blocks the sight of the one who said as he hung on the cross, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. So this was the one then, the one in whom all the humble are represented, that Zacchaeus wanted to see. And so he ignored the crowd that was getting in his way, and instead he climbed a sycamore tree, a tree, so to speak, of silly fruit. The point of Augustine really was that Zacchaeus, because he was humble and unashamed of the cross, and he was unashamed of his desire to see Jesus, was humble and unashamed enough to climb the cross, the tree of silly fruit, and to see Jesus there. You probably know that in the writings of Augustine, there are a lot of themes about the humility of faith against the pride of understanding. Now, I'm not a great Augustinian, because I think understanding is important also, and that's what we're trying to do here. But nevertheless, Augustine has an insight. He was taught a great deal by the Platonists, as he called them, the Neoplatonic philosophers. They taught him really to believe in a spiritual God. And then he later, through his mother's example and others, actually was able to say yes to the grace of being baptized and becoming a Christian. But reflecting on the philosophers, the Platonists, he said, they couldn't bend their necks to the flesh of Christ. You know, for the Platonist, what is fleshly and finite and earthly could not possibly house the divinity. So Augustine points to the fact how they couldn't bend their necks to his becoming human, and also they couldn't bend their necks and have the humility to seeing him in the death on the cross. So I suppose we're reminded that without that kind of attitude of being willing to see and willing to be taught, we don't really come fully to understand the cross. I'll tell you one more story, and I think it's about my father, but he would be happy that I would tell you the story, because it simply was the case. What I'm really trying to say is that God's identification with us in Jesus, which goes right to the depth of the awful things that we suffer, is a real identification, and that sometimes you can catch the presence of Jesus in the kinds of situations of suffering that I'm describing. When my father was old, he got cancer, and he was a scientist and a kind of a practical man. He saw that time was near an end, and even though he often was stubborn and wanted his own way, he walked towards his death with a fair degree of, not exactly welcome, but equanimity, and he realized that life was over. But he took a long time to die because he had a very good heart. I hope I have it too. And, you know, the illness was ravaging him, but the heart was beating. And it was the only time in 40 years of being a Jesuit that I was away from a Jesuit community at Christmas. We're usually with our communities, and that's fine too. But I was with my family, and we were on a kind of vigil. And anyway, I had my few hours on Christmas Day. And somehow, in the organizing of the few hours, and making sure I was also there with the family for the meal, I forgot to go to Mass. Now, for a pious Irishman, reared by the nuns, and told what was what, to not go to Mass on Christmas Day is a tad unusual, whatever about an ordinary Monday or Tuesday. Anyway, I didn't go. Because if I did, I would have missed being with the family, and I was with my father during the time when Mass was on. Only during his funeral Mass did it strike me, it's not true that I didn't go to Mass on the day I was with him on Christmas Day. Because at that stage, he was attached to many tubes. He was as vulnerable as a baby. You couldn't look at this big, strong, giant of a man, much bigger than I, and not see the vulnerability that God undertook by coming into our lives and being humble unto death. I can never quite think of the incarnation the same way, the enfeeblement of God, as it were, and I can't quite think of the cross in the same way either, because I am quite certain, just in that minute or second of consoling insight, I saw for the briefest moment that the man in the bed and the one he was going to were really identified and close. The mystery of the Incarnation and the mystery of the cross are unfathomable because their depths are inexhaustible. I said yesterday that my favorite text in the Mass is, by the mystery of this water and wine, may we come to share in the divinity of Christ, who humbled himself to share in our humanity. My Christmas Mass, my presence at the crib, was seeing my father reduced from strength to absolute enfeeblement and to cross-like pain, just as God had reduced himself from strength to absolute enfeeblement, cross-like pain, and death on our behalf. You, in your own way, in your own lives, have somehow at times intuited similar depths to the mystery of what God has done. But that's what's happening this week, and it's out of love for us. I have still funked it on talking about sacrifice, haven't I? You're laughing because I've said quite little about sacrifice, because I keep stumbling into love. Sacrifice makes no sense for its own sake. But once the reservoir of love is there, the sacrifice is obvious. By this shall all know that you are my disciples, by the love you have one for another. I'm sure when you read that text, you might sometimes feel kind of awful, because there's people I wouldn't take the bullet for. But my question is a bit different. Who would you take the bullet for? Does anybody jump to mind? If one person comes to mind that you would take the bullet for, basically you've got it. And if there's any deficiency, you just haven't got it enough. But you've got it. Because in your intuition that one person is worthy of that kind of sacrifice, you stand in a similar place to what God thought of us. You see what I mean? Christianity, and perhaps within Christianity, Catholicism, is the most pro-life religion, I think. Well, maybe not, because Buddhists don't even kill mosquitoes, right? So we can learn something from them. All right, Christianity is pretty pro-life. Is it absolutely pro-life? No, because you're allowed to give your life for your friend. Christianity, in fact, does not set an absolute on life, because it allows human freedom to make the choice to give away one's life for another. It just makes life relatively absolute, but not absolutely absolute. When you think like that, with love in the backdrop, as the backdrop, then sacrifice begins to make sense. And even though we don't have ritual sacrifices in our cultures, we do use the word quite a lot in our newspapers of soldiers killed in battle. They sacrificed their lives for their country, for freedom. And even if you thought the war wrong, you would admire the soldier who, conscripted, gave his or her life. Of heroic firefighters, you remember 9/11. And that Father Michael Judge, one among many, who going back into the building, never re-emerged. I remember when I lived in Washington, a plane went into the Potomac River. It was Christmas, and some people died trying to rescue passengers from the freezing water. They sacrificed their lives. From lovers, not only in literature, but I know in life, there are 1,000 examples of such sacrifice. Of people who are organ donors. Of an old brother that I knew who did a strange thing during the war. He sacrificed his reputation. He was living in a Jesuit community outside Munich, quite close to the headquarters of the National Socialists, you know. And there was a Jesuit on the run because he was wanted and would be killed if he was found. And one night the brother was locking the door in the basement and he saw these frightened eyes peering in the glass at the top of the door. It was this priest on the run. So the brother let him in, and he put him under the coal by fashioning a kind of room from wood with the coal all around it so that the room was hidden, and he kept him there for about 2 years until the war ended. He told nobody. He didn't tell the superior. He didn't tell any other person. Didn't tell any member of his family. He kept the secret himself. But the problem was to feed the man. Rations were scarce. And one day there had been a feast day and the food was slightly better. And after the meal, it was one of the jobs of this brother to clear away the food and to carefully put the remaining food in a cool place. But he slipped it onto a plate and put a bit of greaseproof paper on top of it and was heading to that secret place when he ran into the superior, who looked at the plate and looked at him and said, Brother Stephen, he said, I'd expect that kind of greed of many, but not of you. He said, sorry, Father, I have been weak. I think you know loads of stories like that. And they're not just of the canonized saints. People have an instinct for the meaning of sacrifice, and whether it's reputation, funds, things dearer to us, life itself. We know, too, that it can mean something really deep, provided that sacrifice is never made an end in itself, but always linked to the commitment of love. In all this, am I making some sense to you? And I'm not taking away the idea that the cross is a sacrifice, but having insisted that Jesus comes both out of solidarity in love and also with the desire to save, I want to insist that that love is the ocean out of which everything else flows. And that so when we speak of his sacrifice, We don't think of it in terms of God demanding some pound of flesh, or go around feeling bad all the time because he had to give it up for us. He did it out of love. He would do it again. He does it all the time. Listen to this quotation from the well-known French Jesuit, Henri de Lubac. Jesus Christ will be in agony until the end of the world. The sturdy lesson Pascal, you know, the French guy, immediately draws from this, this is common knowledge, and it is, we must not sleep during this time. But there's another aspect of the mystery of Jesus. There is other fruit, nearer and sweeter. Until the end of the world, Jesus will be in agony. Yes. Until the end of the world, he will be nailed, with arms outstretched, on the cross. Whatever time it be, at whatever moment of my life, I can always go to the garden, to Calvary. I can really find Jesus there. I can shelter my agony under his. His laceration upholds my own. That naive outburst of Peter's on the mountain of the Transfiguration, that wish of his that could not be granted then and cannot be even now, can be voiced by me, by us, when we come to Calvary or enter the garden. Lord, it is good for us to be here, and we are sure, quite sure, of never being repulsed. I'm sorry I don't have a watch, but I think we've come to the end of our time. So I think we'll have some reflective time. I'll also be around afterwards if anybody wants to say anything to me, and I hope that's helpful.